Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're opening replaying a segment reminding residents about the lingering dangers of lead in and around their homes and neighborhoods with an environmental sanitarian from Meriden who plays a role in a larger statewide effort to remind residents about the dangers posed by lead, which is especially risky to children. We're going to learn all the places where lead could still be lurking and places where kids and others could still be exposed and how that lead exposure can be remediated forever. Then we'll catch a buzz with the Backyard Beekeepers Association and learn why becoming even a simple backyard beekeeper could be one of the best holiday gifts you can give yourself, your family, your community, and the environment, and why now is the best time of year to get into beekeeping. Finally, have you ever had a bad experience with an uncaring medical professional? Who hasn't? Well, meet the Patient Is You Foundation, helping medical practitioners enhance humanistic, compassionate patient care with unsurpassed customer service and sharing its philosophies with patients as well as institutional and non-institutional healthcare providers, anyone who comes into contact with patients or their families. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Ask any educator. Teaching can be demanding and stressful as much as it is rewarding and fun. Add a pandemic and a new school year to the equation, and the stress can seem overwhelming. One of the best ways to manage stress is by talking about it with those who understand. And Positive Directions, the Center for Prevention and Counseling in Westport, is inviting educators to join this supportive group where you'll be surrounded by peers working together to support each other and build resilience. Join this counselor-led peer support group every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. via Zoom. To learn more and reserve your seat, call 203-227-7644 or visit positivedirections.org. Well, as we indicated in the introduction this morning, we're going to start off talking about a subject that continues to come up here on the award-winning For the People. I was telling Rodney in a prior call that, you know, way back 28, 29 years ago when I first started broadcasting For the People, one of the very first interviews that I did was in regards to lead poisoning. And it's kind of ironic and maybe even a little bit sad, Rodney, that here we are almost three decades later. And, you know, not only is some of that lead paint that could have been poisoning kids way back 28 or 29 years ago may still be out there and poisoning kids today, two generations later.
Yeah.
But the problem is still out there and it's prevalent. And, you know, we're finding new places where lead could be lurking. So I really appreciate you joining us. For folks listening, Rodney Delgado is an environmental health sanitarian with the Meriden Health Department, and he's one of a legion of public health experts throughout the state of Connecticut that are part of a lead poisoning prevention and control program coordinated through the Connecticut Department of Public Health that is designed to protect the health and safety of people here in Connecticut by preventing lead poisoning and promoting wellness through education and a wide range of program activities related to lead poisoning prevention and specifically childhood lead poisoning prevention. So Rodney, I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, do you remember situations as you were becoming trained and educated as a environmental health professional when, you know, as you were learning about it, you were thinking back maybe to your childhood or your years growing up in situations and saying, yeah, I bet there was lead or lead paint where I was?
Well, first thing I want to say is thank you very much for this opportunity to get lead poisoning prevention out there and get information out to the community.
Sure.
And it's interesting you say that because I still work in the community that I lived in, that I grew up in, and I'm actually about 2 minutes away from the house that I grew up in. And every time I drive by the house, I look at I look at the paint, I look at the siding, I look at what's there, and there's no doubt in my mind that we had lead paint in there. I remember growing up, running around the house, grabbing water out of the hose from the side of the house, and then when I first started this job, testing some of the water in basements and some of those pipes, you can I tested a couple of the water, and it did come up positive for lead. So as I interact with some of these houses, I think about how I grew up, where I grew up, the house that I grew up in, the neighborhood that I grew up in, and just everything that I see now, it's bringing me, like, should we say, full circle, and thinking, well, I was exposed to lead there. I used to play in that dirt, and that dirt, there used to be a building there, and that had lead in there. So I'm very thankful that I never was tested positive. I'm thankful that I never came up positive for lead. But I was lucky. I was very lucky.
Well, I think a lot of people who aren't impacted by it, who don't actually have a child or someone in the household that may be exhibiting the kind of symptoms that lead them to be tested and find out that they have high levels of lead in their system, I don't think they realize how prevalent a problem it still is. Childhood lead poisoning, the most common pediatric public health issue facing Connecticut and the nation still today in 2020, right?
Yeah, it's going to be up there. And the problem with lead poisoning is there's no symptoms right off the bat. I tell my families that when you start seeing symptoms of lead poisoning, it's already too late. It starts with developmental delays and behavioral issues, and once the lead actually affects the child's brain and the child's development, it's not something that they're not going to get better from. It's going to affect their life. So I think that's one of the main issues, that because you don't physically see anything and there's nothing tangible where, yes, this child is showing this symptom, let me get it tested for lead. You don't have that with lead poisoning.
So, in fact, lead through whatever source is creating it, it could be kind of building up very slowly in a young child, and kind of coincidentally, sadly, like COVID-19, they could be affected by this for a long period of time before the signs begin to show.
Yes, there's always that potential. Most of the time, like state guidelines, is that the child should be tested twice before they turn 2 years old. Specifically in Meriden, we add an additional test for a child to be registered for kindergarten. So I get three results before the child gets into kindergarten. Well, I have access to three results, and that's usually the only way that families know, yes, my child has lead and has been poisoned with lead.
Well, let's switch gears and start talking about areas of exposure. You kind of mentioned a number of them where you were kind of exposed to as a child yourself. The most common, I guess, is being in paint that probably was applied in homes prior to about 1978, 79?
Yeah, in 78. They stopped using lead in about 78. So any of these older houses, and if you're in a home built in 1950, 1900, somewhere there's going to be some type of lead paint. Eventually, and because lead paint at that time was durable, they used it on the exterior of homes. Eventually, as wind breaks down the paint, Mother Nature takes care of the erosion, all the dust and all the flakes and everything will get into the soil. So whenever a soil gets tested positive for lead, it's remnants of lead from the actual paint, for the most part, from the actual paint on the outside of the house. Back a long time ago, they were using lead pipes, copper pipes with lead solder to hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, whether it's hot or cold water, eventually the lead will leach into the water, and that's another source that a child can get poisoned if the house has lead has pipes with lead in it.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it will leach in. And if a child's drinking and nobody pays attention to it, nobody's aware of it, that's another way that a child can get lead.
So is it, it for situations where it may have broken down and flaked off and got into soil, mm-hmm. is it a situation where if the children are playing or running or actually digging in that dirt, they breathe it in and that's how they contract mm-hmm. it? Or does it actually get on their hands and it kind of goes through their skin? How do kids get it?
The majority of the time, it's hand-to-mouth exposure. So if a child is the child doesn't have to be specifically playing in the dirt. If the child, say, is playing with a ball and the ball rolls into the dirt and potentially the dirt has lead in it, well, the child's not going to go over there and wipe the ball off. The child's going to pick the ball up and start playing with it.
Right.
As a child, like whether the child is hungry and grabs a cookie, like whether a child is a notorious thumb sucker, mm-hmm. or eventually at some point the child may find their hands in their mouth somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the majority of the ways that a child would get the lead. It's just ingestion that way.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other locations where lead might still be prevalent enough so that enough of a period of exposure could make a difference?
In terms of other sources?
Yeah.
There's certain toys coming from overseas. Obviously, here in the United States, we have our guidelines, regulations, and we do a lot of recalls. Well, sometimes some of the toys that are coming from overseas, they would have paint that has been mixed in with lead, and they're using that to paint these specific toys. There are cases where home remedies and herbal supplements, again, coming from whatever location it's coming from, whether it's naturally has lead in it or whether it was added to it or whether it was mixed in, that's another, I don't want to say popular way, but not a prevalent way of a child getting poisoned.
Okay.
Sometimes I had one child that was exposed to a high performance jet ski gasoline that had lead in it.
Oh, okay.
And whether the child at specific tournaments was breathing it in through the exhaust from all the jet skis or physically had it poured on her hand or it spilled on her, specifically going through her skin, the way it got into her body, I'm not positive. I just know that if the family didn't tell me anything, the only thing that I found with doing my investigation was this jet ski gasoline, this jet ski fuel.
Well, let's talk a little bit for the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have with you, Rodney, about prevention and what parents or care providers and even landlords need to know and how they could go about working to ensure that they live in or care for children in a lead-free environment.
Okay. For property owners, property maintainers, the easiest way is if there's anything deteriorating, any chipping or flaking paint, and the areas that are chipping, 2 coats of paint. That's the easiest effective way. Put the paint back into an intact state. Once that's done, before or after, wet cleaning. How everybody is cleaning in regards to COVID-19, like similar things could be done for lead, whether it's wet cleaning the floors, the windows, anything anywhere that the child is exposed to, cleaning the toys that the child normally plays with, if it's a stuffed animal, washing that. But just a wet cleaning process eliminates a lot of the dust, eliminates a lot of the potential.
Mm-hmm.
For children, hand washing. And as a sanitarian, we're always talking to food service establishments about hand washing. Well, this goes along with lead as well. If the child is playing outside, if the child is playing inside, if the child is notorious for putting his or her hand in the mouth, we want to make sure that the hand is washed as best as possible. And I'm not talking about hand sanitizer. A lot of my families mistake that. I'm saying, no, soap and water. Like, I've even had some families use, like, we're out in the park, use the little wipes, the baby wipes, just to wipe down their hands before they actually have something to eat, and try to limit any of the hand-to-mouth contact if they're outside.
Excellent.
Just hand washing is key for all of this.
Okay. Any other points that we may have yet missed that you need to remind people about?
Just that lead poisoning is 100% preventable, but it takes everybody involved. It takes the caretakers or the parents of the child. It takes the landlord to maintain their property. We want to get the doctors involved and make sure that they're doing the appropriate testing at the appropriate times. There just has to be open communication with everybody involved. And we have to do this all together because, like you said, this has been 3 decades plus of issues with lead. Mm-hmm. And now we're in 2020 and we're still dealing with lead cases and still dealing with kids being poisoned with lead. And it's honestly for no reason.
Sure. Well, obviously you're doing great work day to day in your
job as an environmental
health sanitarian for the Meriden Health Department. But now you're a spokesman for the cause for the entire state of Connecticut and maybe even folks that are listening to the show down in New York, over on Long Island, or by podcast somewhere else in the world. Hopefully you're doing some good for them as well and helping to keep their children and families lead free. Childhood lead poisoning is the most common pediatric public health problem today, yet it's entirely preventable. You can find the Connecticut Lead Poisoning Prevention and Control Program through any search engine, or if you have questions, you can call them at 860-509-7299. That's 860-509-7299 at the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Rodney Delgado, great to make your acquaintance. Great work you're doing.
Same.
Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for, like, again, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Well, as you heard during the introduction, maybe one of the last things that you're thinking about right now as we hit the holiday grind here a week before Christmas, we're in the middle of various holiday celebrations. Certainly we've tasted here in Connecticut our first real dose of winter 2020-21 with this storm this week. So the furthest thing from your mind would be springtime, maybe, but definitely raising bees in your yard, becoming a backyard beekeeper. But in fact, as I learned in chatting with our guest a little bit offline yesterday, now is actually the best time to start thinking about being a backyard beekeeper. And she's here to tell you why that is. Now is the time, as well as how you can get into that. She has been a bee school instructor for many, many years, and she is a director and past president of the Backyard Beekeepers Association. Leslie Houston is on the line with us. Leslie, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time this morning. First of all,
glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome. So the big question, I guess, is why here, smack dab in the middle of the holiday season, should we even be thinking about springtime and the prospect of maybe either starting, restarting, or sustaining a beekeeping hobby in our yard?
Well, it's not something that you can do just on the turn of a dime. You have to, you'll want to get some education. And at this time of year, associations around the area here are having their various bee classes. You also need to make some decisions on what kind of equipment you're going to get. Reserve a package of bees now or soon. in order to have them arrive for you later in the spring when the time is right. But you have to place the reservations ahead. So now's the time to think about it and make a move if you want to do it this summer, this spring and summer.
I guess since it started catching headlines a little over a decade ago with the significant, if not alarming, drop in bee populations, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country and around the globe, people started thinking more about, well, maybe this is a different alternative to doing a backyard garden, or maybe doing it as a complement to a backyard garden. Is it true that backyard beekeeping has really kind of taken off over the past decade?
Oh, for sure, for sure. A lot of people that have gardens have kind of keyed into the fact that having bees in the area is a necessary as well as just another aspect of gardening and the ecosystem to sort of pay respect to and pay attention to. So if you have bees in the area, you will have bigger fruits, more flowers, setting seed if you do that. So it's a valuable aspect. And of course, you got a shot at getting some honey from your own backyard, and that never hurts.
Sure. Make a lot of friends that way, too.
Yes.
They make little honey gift packages for birthdays or holidays is a nice thing. And certainly, as people are learning more about the benefits of having bees in their backyard, you could probably speak a little bit to the understanding that consuming honey, especially raw honey, also has some positive health benefits. So I guess, just like some people that like to get the milk straight from the cow, getting that freshest kind of raw honey is a good thing for people's health.
Absolutely. Raw honey from a local beekeeper will have the pollen from the area. And if you have allergies, that's good to have in trace amounts to sort of help your body maybe desensitize itself to that local pollen. Also, it's been much less processed, so the flavor and the aroma is still complete in that raw honey, and you're supporting a local business, a local beekeeper.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Backyard Beekeepers Association has been around a lot longer than this kind of explosion in interest in beekeeping. You've been teaching the bee school for a long time, and we're going to talk after the break about how people can sign up for that and what to expect when they do. But in the short turnaround, as you have been counseling people on keeping bees, I imagine along with the explosion in interest, there has been an explosion in the industries that support backyard beekeeping in terms of making products and equipment that's easy to handle. Although I see a lot of the good old-fashioned stacked box beehives around, there are also hives that kind of rest above the ground, like a pocket garden. Talk a little bit about the equipment involved and how much easier it is to be a beekeeper today, or even to have a hive right in your backyard.
Well, it's not tough to have a hive in your backyard. It doesn't take a lot of real estate per se. You can nestle it into the garden. You can put it on the back fence. We do advise people to sort of take a look at how the property is used and your neighbor's properties. You don't want to sort of aim your beehive's entrance at your neighbor's driveway or pathway so that the bees are kind of coming and going in the greatest number and creating any kind of a nuisance. But they generally are easy to accommodate. They can even be on a deck. Once they get settled in, they just kind of come and go and just want to do their own thing, and they don't hang around too much right in the area creating too much trouble. So they're real easy to accommodate. You can have a couple of hives even in a real small spot of land. And the bees are not going to stay on your own property. They're easily going to fly 2 or 3 miles to visit all the flowers in that area. So it's not like you have to have all the flowers for your bees on your property.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to visit the neighborhood.
So if a person is thinking, we're listening to this program on the radio or on the podcast, this B school is going to be starting up in January. Maybe we'll sign up and see what it's all about. Can you talk a little bit about the expectation of expense or cost to somebody who may be starting for the very first time?
Yeah, thumbnails. Costs would be the equipment itself, the beehive, just the woodenware or the house that the bees are going to live in. It's probably a couple hundred dollars. The tools that you're going to want to have for yourself, the beekeeper, you know, some hive tool and a veil and a smoker, maybe a pair of nice leather gloves. That's going to be another $50 to $100, depending on the types that you choose. And then a package of bees, which is what I was talking about earlier, you have to reserve it in the winter, and it'll arrive probably in April in our area. That's about $150, too.
Okay. So easily under $500 can get you started. And once all of those components are in place, the only renewable source that people may need is more bees. Or once people get that initial shipment of bees, they will reproduce and sustain over a period of years.
Well, hopefully your bees will survive, but that is a challenge. So, yes, the woodenware and the tools you'll be able to use for many, many years. And if your bees survive, then they will be around for also the following season and onward. Mm-hmm. You may be able to split your bees and make, you know, get another hive and make two hives out of one. You may also have your bees die over winter and need to replace them. Again, just the bees, not the equipment.
Okay. And before we take a break, your website provides a great resource. It's backyardbeekeepers.com. But there are also support groups, not just through your organization, but social networking groups, certainly even other beekeepers in the neighborhood. This becomes a very kind of socially driven place for information for people who are just starting. Veterans, I'm sure, generally love to mentor and assist newbies, right? Sorry, the pun. Excuse the pun.
Oh, no, we use the term newbies liberally.
I bet you do.
Yes, it's a very socially driven thing. Beekeepers are social animals just like the bees are. So the club provides meetings and mentorship, and there are Facebook groups out there. We have regular meetings as well as workshops, and we, you know, when we can gather in person, we do that and share our experiences and our knowledge and bring new beekeepers along as best we can.
Fantastic. Leslie Houston, our newest beekeeping friend here on the award-winning For the People. She's a director and past president and longtime bee school instructor for the Backyard Beekeepers Association. Backyardbeekeepers.com is their website. And when we come back from our break, we're going to tell you how to sign up for their next round of bee school. And the good news is, the classroom is huge. It's going to be virtual, so there's no limit on the number of people, but we do want to get you signed up, as Leslie explained, because now is the time. We'll explain more about that and tell you how to get signed up for a bee school right after the break. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity or ramping up for volunteer efforts in 2021, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Boquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this. The COVID-19 pandemic has dramatically increased demand for pets as people seek adding a pet to the family to ease the loneliness and tension of a prolonged time at home. With this rising demand has come a spike in pet scams in which an online search ends with a would-be pet owner paying hundreds of dollars or more to purchase a pet that ultimately doesn't exist. Better Business Bureau advises extreme caution when shopping for a pet online, especially in light of scammers evolving tactics, and they offer this advice. See the pet in person before paying any money. In light of the COVID-19 pandemic, consider a video chat with the seller so you can see the seller and the actual pet for sale. Do a reverse image search if you see a photo of a pet to make sure it's legit. Do research to get a sense of a fair price for the breed you're considering. And before considering purchasing a new pet, check out local animal shelters online for pets you can meet before adopting who'd love a second chance at being your new best friend. Happy hunting for your new holiday pet. Don't forget, this is a commitment you're going to be making for 8, 10, 15 years, and select and make your decisions carefully. We're back, and we're visiting with Leslie Houston. She is a director and past president of the Backyard Beekeepers Association. They are based in Weston, but will certainly welcome anyone within the sound of our voice. She is also a longtime instructor of the Backyard Beekeepers Association Bee School, along with a number of other beekeeping associations across the state. They are ramping up their bee school schedules, and this year, due to the virus, there is an actual benefit. Right. Normally, I'm told the bee school has a limited number of participations, and once they're full, the door is closed. But now, thanks to virtual opportunities, this year's Bee School through the Backyard Beekeepers Association is virtually unlimited in terms of the amount of students that they can bring in to teach. So, Leslie, tell us a little bit about what people should expect in terms of the Bee School and the schedule and the kind of homework that they might have to do.
Sure. The Backyard Beekeepers Bee School will be meeting on Mondays in January, Monday evening, 7 to 9. It will be via Zoom, as you mentioned. We'll cover everything from soup to nuts about beekeeping, how to go about choosing your equipment and getting your reservations placed, how to install your bees and inspect your colonies, what to watch out for in terms of pests and diseases, how to provide for them and get them ready through the summer to harvest any honey and get them ready for winter. So we cover all of that in those four sessions, and it's a lot of fun. We have a good time doing it. It will be a little different doing it by Zoom, but I'm sure we'll still have a great time. Mm-hmm. You can register through the website, backyardbeekeepers.com. The class costs $50. That includes 1 year's membership in the Backyard Beekeepers as well as the class.
Excellent. I'm interested, you say you have to order your bees, now or in the winter, get your order in early. Obviously, as I've seen from like informational posters at NOFA activities and various other farm markets and things, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of different types of species of bees. When you say honeybee, is that one specific kind of bee, and those are the bees that people will be ordering to start their backyard beekeeping experience?
That's right. The honeybees are the ones that we keep in the boxes in our yards and that are used so throughout the U.S. for pollination and things. But, yeah, there are a whole host of other kinds of bees. There are bumblebees. There are small native solitary bees. And they're all valuable in pollinating and as part of the ecosystem. So we're kind of interested in promoting honeybees and beekeeping in the traditional sense, but also all the pollinators, so we support the work of the pollinator pathway and the green corridor kinds of things and, less lawn, more meadow kind of movement to allow for all of these kinds of insects to flourish.
Well, this certainly dovetails with the efforts of a number of guests on our program, including the Aspetuck Land Trust, who are promoting this Pollinator Pathways Initiative. Can you just explain to people, you know, aside from the fun and the discovery of beekeeping and the bounty of wonderful honey you get, what are some of the other benefits in terms of the pollinator pathway and how you can really make your yard and your neighborhood and your environment a whole lot better and healthier by participating even in the smallest scope of scale for beekeeping?
Yeah, well, you know, the more land that we turn back to a more natural management system, the better off our pollinators and our, you know, animals in general will be. Fewer chemicals in the environment, in the soil, in the air, lets everything sort of rebound and be a little more resilient and endure climate change and other challenges that they face.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of other activities that Backyard Beekeepers Association is at least trying to put together for 2021, you know, we're assuming at some point society itself is going to return to a lot more open and hands-on situation. In a normal year, or perhaps for 2021, what are some of the other types of activities that you're offering to members and those in the general public?
Well, we have monthly regular membership meetings. They are also open to the public. We have speakers join us. Normally, they join us in person. Of late, they've been joining us by Zoom. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing that for at least the beginning part of 2021, but we hope to get back to in-person gatherings. And then we also support our membership with a whole range of workshops throughout the season. You know, Bee School is in January to help you get jump started in your beekeeping adventure. But we have workshops throughout the year to experience and learn.
Very good. Wrap up just by reminding people where they need to go and what they need to do to get started, at least with the Backyard Beekeepers Association. We will wish you a happy holidays and send you on your way for now, and hopefully revisit Backyard Beekeepers again, maybe in the thick of the season, and see how things are going. But remind folks of the website and the information they need to attend Bee School coming up in early January.
Yeah, it starts on January 4th. The website is backyardbeekeepers.com, and there you'll find a link to where you can register for Bee School. There are gift certificates available, and I hope we'll see a bunch of folks on January 4th.
Excellent. Backyard Beekeepers provides its members with a forum for sharing knowledge in beekeeping and is dedicated to educating beekeepers and promoting the benefits of beekeeping to the public. Their director, former president, and bee school instructor is Leslie Houston, our guest this morning. Leslie, really appreciate it. Have a great holiday, and we'll talk to you again next year. Well, I have come to know a brand new nonprofit, maybe not new in respect to their work, but in respect to the award-winning For the People, and I'm so pleased to make their acquaintance. TPIU Foundation is who we're going to be talking about in this segment. That stands for The Patient Is You, and this foundation's goal in part is to empower and share philosophies to institutional healthcare providers like hospitals, surgery centers, nursing homes, as well as non-institutional providers like doctors, nurses, medical secretaries, or anyone that comes into contact with patients or their families, among a number of things that they do. And we'll learn all about it with Dr. Michael Crane. He's on the line with us this morning from The Patient Is You. Dr. Crane, happy holidays. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I just clipped a tiny little piece of the volumes of information from your website, tpiu.org. But before we even talk about the foundation, let's just talk a little bit about you. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to be affiliated with The Patient Is You.
I'm a practicing a radiologist, and I have a radiology office, and we have always practiced kind, compassionate care, in that we are happy to talk to our patients. We listen to the patients. We help direct them whenever possible. So the founder of TPIU, Dr. K.J. Lee, had gotten to know me and asked if I would help with his foundation. Mm-hmm. And I said yes, and that was a few years ago. And it's been a very exciting process to learn about how important compassionate health care is, not only because it makes you feel good, but it actually improves patient outcome, you know, and it decreases the health care costs to our society. So compassionate care is so important for everybody, you know, not just certain people.
Yeah. Well, these days when healthcare careers are sometimes looked upon as a kind of a protected job, one that's not going out of business, so to speak, and is offering a broad variety of training for similar types of positions, depending on where you go to school and get your degree and get certified. Unfortunately, so many of the horror stories that we hear, and of course, that is acquiescing to the point that you know, when you're good, nobody remembers, and when you're bad, nobody forgets. We still hear so many horror stories that may not involve the outcome of a procedure or the hands-on aspect of a visit, but how unpleasant or disconnected or difficult the interaction is between the patient and the provider or the healthcare professionals who may be putting hands on to an individual patient's procedures or activities. So your organization really is an important one.
Correct. I mean, we're here to empower the providers to let them know that we are supporting them and supporting the time that they spend with their patients and trying to, you know, in the long run, provide incentives to them to take the time and be compassionate. Because I think that all the doctors, when they are young, learn to be compassionate, and they lose it along the way as the pressures of society and the pressures of the government tell them to work harder and faster and faster. And you know, we'd like to bring them back to where they started from, and just let them know that this, you're, by taking the few minutes to listen to the patient and to answer their questions, you're going to improve their outcome, and that's really what you want to do.
Mm. Now,
you know, that's their aim. Mm-hmm.
Do medical professionals individually find the patient as you and find that something within your mission resonates with them, whether it's something they feel they're not being supported to do, or maybe, you know, a piece of the bedside manner initiative that may have been lost due to the push and the churn that they're forced to undergo in their day-to-day work, especially, you know, in the past year or so as COVID-19 has ramped up and the demands have been just so overwhelming.
There are enormous numbers of people who resonate with our foundation. Before the pandemic in October of 2019, we had a gala, or we invited people all walks of life to hear about our foundation and to support us, and we had over 300 people come to hear us, and doctors and government officials and community members, and I think that they heard us loud and clear. Unfortunately, then came the pandemic, and so we've taken a different route You know, we can't all meet together, so we've been doing podcasts and public service announcements and talking to people who have COVID and trying to help them, you know, through this tough time. But I'm looking forward to getting back to where we were before COVID. I just got my vaccine yesterday, the first dose. So I'm hoping that we can get back to all being together again and have more conferences and things like that to let the doctors know, you know, how important compassionate care is and how important it is to spend those few extra minutes with the patients.
So is it your goal to try to resonate with each individual healthcare provider and hope that they seek you out and avail themselves to your broad range of services, support, and programs? Or do institutions actually come to you and say, how can you help us with our entire team?
Right now, we're focused on Connecticut. Mm-hmm. We're focused on the healthcare providers in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So I think that the big institutions have their own programs for compassionate care, which is very, very important. And they do a great job at promoting compassionate care. But in the everyday sector of patients and doctors and all throughout our communities, I think there could be a lack of compassion. You know, and by all means, many, many physicians do practice what we talk about. And it's a matter of helping the other ones and giving them the incentive or you know, the support to provide that kind of care.
Great. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Michael Kane. He's with an organization called TPIU Foundation. It stands for The Patient Is You, and you can find them on the web at tpiu.org. If you're any type of a medical professional, from brain surgeon on down, they are happy to hear from you and help you reconnect or shore up your compassionate support. Support and a number of other talents that maybe have waned a little bit or been worn down, particularly over the past year as the crunch of demand and challenges in the COVID-19 era have taken effect. Dr. Crane, talk a little bit more about compassionate care. You said that it will improve the way that the patient feels about the provider, but it also has, you know, very positive, as you pointed out earlier, impact on that patient's care, attitude, and recovery.
Right. You know, there are example after example, but for instance, you know, there was a study that took diabetic patients and who were on insulin and looked at them whether they were with a compassionate provider or just a routine clinic. And they found that those diabetics who had a compassionate healthcare provider had an 80% better control of their blood sugar than those not in a compassionate setting. And if you control your blood sugar, you have less complications. Mm-hmm. So they also had 40% chance of diabetic complications because the doctor explained to the patient why it was important to take the medication and to help them understand that they're part of the team. And, you know, so that was just one example of how the compassionate care can help decrease costs by having less complications, less hospitalizations, and better patient outcomes. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win situation.
Yeah. There also, while your focus is primarily on the healthcare provider. Would you be able to provide any advice or support to the patient if, you know, given the fact that this program is probably reaching, 100 times more patients than it is providers, does the patient have a place or a right or a responsibility to, if not demand, to at least expect compassionate care and ask for it if they feel they're not getting it?
Absolutely. And our organization actually is trying to help empower the providers and also to educate the patients for what kind of care they should expect. And so we have public service announcements to the patients. We have emails and to let them know that they need to be asking the right questions. So we have on our website, we have lists of questions that they should be asking their providers and to get the right information. And if they're not, you know, they should ask for it or find a provider who can give them that kind of care.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically both parties need to be educated, need to be involved in this process. Mm. It can't be just the provider or the patient. And as I say, on our website, www.tpiu.org, we have, those questions in patient information and are always willing to help, teach the patients how important it is. We show examples of, what is a compassionate encounter versus a not compassionate encounter,
mm-hmm.
Because some may not even know. What this means, but it's really just a kind of interaction where the provider listens to the patients,
mm-hmm.
and finds out, what their issues are and try to help them.
Very good. In the last minute or so that we have with you, Dr. Crane, have you either anecdotally or as an organization with the patient as you found that there are either particular demographics of medical providers or particular types of practice or service delivery specialists who are more inclined to be less compassionate, perhaps through no fault of their own, but just because they're under such tremendous pressure to push more patients every hour, make the visits quicker, snap it up. Any age groups or particular types of practices where you see there tends to be, a little bit less compassion happening?
Right. I mean, there are many wonderful, for instance, healthcare clinics and things like that who provide great care, and some don't. There's a group of people who are maybe less educated, who don't understand how important, for instance, medications are. There's going to be a group of people who are older, the elderly, who need that extra help. There's surely going to be sectors, in our state where we need to push, this message.
Mm.
And that's exactly what we try to do.
Very good. I'm glad we made your acquaintance, Dr. Crane, as well as learned that the patient is you, is active and alive and well and based right here in Connecticut and working to do so much. We look forward to talking with you, on an ongoing basis as you begin to expand hands-on programming again. But for now, we will leave it at that. We thank you for your time this morning. We hope folks will visit TPIU. CPIU.org. The Patient Is You Foundation educates patients and potential patients on how to navigate a very complex healthcare system, and they want to be the wings of caregivers to support them, increase their morale. In this complex era where patients are asked to rate the practice and the physician, it behooves the attending physician to communicate clearly about the care, as well as introduce the team of caregivers, including but not limited to nurse practitioners, physician assistants, nurses, fellows, residents, and medical students. TPIU is helping make that happen. If you want to learn more about them and your medical provider or student or a caregiver or potential patient, just go to TPIU.org. And once again, thank you so much, Dr. Crane, for your time this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.